Hi everyone and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone and welcome back to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the gaming industry from the past couple of weeks. My name is Patrick Beja and today we have a bunch of really interesting topics we have to cover. Sony and their crossplay issues and embarrassment. We are also going to be talking about battle passes, which are apparently becoming the craze of the entire industry. Well, at least parts of it, and a bunch of other little tidbits. And to analyze all of this, we have two wonderful people who are joining me on the show. First, Daniel, which you've heard before, JugeEX from Twitter. Can I say from Twitter or analyst of the gaming world? How's it going, Daniel?
Yeah, you can say from Twitter, and it's going good, Patrick. How's everything with you?
Ah, it's going well. As I was joking about before the show started, the baby is sleeping right now, so I'm happy. That's the binary state of my life. Happy when baby sleeps, unhappy when baby doesn't sleep.
That is the best state to be in.
I guess so. He woke up like six times tonight, so he is teething, and I think that's why he woke up. But yeah, babies, think really hard before you decide to have one. It's an interesting experience. We also have Nate Langson joining us from Bloomberg / Text Message podcast. How's it going, Nate?
It's very good, thank you. I probably slept a little bit more than you did last night, but I've heard that babies cause tiredness.
I've been empirically testing this this theory, and I can confirm it is true. Unlike your, what is it, giants and African snails that are the size of your hand, of which you have four of?
That's right, giant African land snails. They're pretty big. Yeah, I mean the ones we've got at the moment will get an awful lot bigger. But if you do a Google image for giant African land snails, you'll see how big some of them can come. And you'll probably find my wife's website because she's, I think, like the fourth highest ranked website in Britain for giant land snail information. So
that is interesting, and I'm not sure I'm going to Google it because it might give me nightmare. Although, they probably don't wake you up as much at night by their screaming and teething. So there's a good side to having land snails as well.
Very true.
All right. Let's get started with the first topic, I think, from the past couple of weeks, which is kind of a follow-up to what had been happening during and right after E3. As we all know, Fortnite has been made available on Switch, and that created an issue for crossplay that existed before but wasn't as visible with Sony's stance on the matter. So Sony has been for years now defending the idea that they don't want crossplay with other console manufacturers. You can crossplay many games with PCs or maybe even mobile, in the case of Fortnite, but with other consoles manufacturers, which used to mean Microsoft and the Xbox One, they prevent crossplay from happening, which is not a technical issue. They tell you it's because they don't want to have people that interact in your game that they don't have control over for moderation purposes, but that seems like a very thin excuse for what is actually a competitive advantage they want to give themselves. Since they are the biggest player for this generation of consoles, well, they want to keep you in their walled garden. Now, of course, the arrival of the Switch kind of switches this from a binary proposition where you have Microsoft on one end and Sony on the other, and that's kind of the state of the world. And it creates a situation where Sony is isolated and isolating, and everyone else is playing happily together. You even have Microsoft and Nintendo leaning very heavily on this with communication ads, or at least one ad, which has been promoting the idea that you can play together on those platforms. The added insult to the injury is the fact that when you create an account, or when you link a PlayStation account to your Epic Fortnite account, then, and that's really the biggest issue I feel, or the biggest catalyst, it prevents you from linking your Epic account to any other console manufacturers. And again, I think when it was just Sony and Microsoft, it was like, well, you're either playing on one or the other, and that's, you know, we're begrudgingly accepted. But now that there's a third player, it really isolates Sony and puts a big focus on the fact that they won't let you, I mean, they actively block your account from being linked anywhere else, which is them inserting themselves into the way you interact with your account, your friends, and everything. And to be fair, we don't quite know if Sony is mandating that you can't link the accounts of other manufacturers, or if it's behind the scenes Epic kind of pushing Sony's buttons by saying, well, if you want us to not enable crossplay, then that's the way we have to do it, when really what they could be doing is flag PlayStation people who are playing on PlayStation at the moment and not matchmake them with others. And that would not necessitate the actual blocking of linking accounts from other manufacturers. We don't quite know what's going on behind the scenes, but the reality is it is a very bad look for Sony. It is a pretty bad move, I think, from Sony. And things have changed very much in recent years, but we're going to discuss this a little bit. What do you guys think about this whole debacle? I think it's turning into a PR, a big PR issue for Sony. We've seen interviews and articles published on mass media, and they're not looking good at all. Nate, do you have an opinion on this? Is Sony to blame? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to hazard a guess on this, I would definitely put the responsibility at Sony's door, largely because if you look at the history of Sony's love of cross-play, it's not necessarily been particularly, there's not been a lot of love for it there.
If you remember, there was actively fought it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we had this with Rocket League. I think we had this with Minecraft possibly as well. You know, Sony's not been not enjoyed this, and then supporting the argument, I think that Sony is probably at fault. Well, say at fault, it's their business decision, but certainly the Sony's you know, to reinforce that this may be Sony's doing, is why would Epic not want it to work on PlayStation? I mean, it's on almost every platform imaginable at this point, you know, and soon will be on Android. So why on earth would they not want someone to be able to do cross play on PlayStation?
Of course.
And I, you know, part of me wonders whether there are issues with the back end side of Sony that it's just very difficult for their multiplayer servers to link up. Maybe integration is very difficult. Maybe they have limited developer resource, although I find that hard to believe for, you know, the biggest games platform maker in the world right now.
Yeah, so there's another little bit of shenanigans by Epic. When the game launched initially for, like, I don't know, 24 hours, Epic actually enabled crossplay. They said it was a mistake, it was a setting issue, and they quickly corrected it. So PlayStation players were then isolated again very quickly. But it can also be read as Epic trying to push or at least to convey the fact, I was going to say the idea, but the fact that it is technically possible. So this question of, well, is it really doable? Do they have other issues that prevent it? Was actually negated by the fact that it was possible for a few hours when it first launched. And I think that was intentional from Epic's part.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all, and it just reinforces the belief that it's something on Sony's end, which again doesn't make any sense, particularly for a free-to-play game like this, because you want that community to be as large as possible, because if it's as large as possible outside of Sony's platform, then it's more compelling for people on Sony's platform to want to play, because a multiplayer game with no other players is not a game. It's just a pointless waste of server space. So there's really no incentive for Sony to try and block this. And I know that in the past, Sony has allowed, you know, some integration. I remember when the MMORPG Elder Scrolls Online launched on consoles after initially being on PC and Mac, there was a period where you could port your character over to PlayStation or Xbox, and you had to do it within a certain window, and the accounts remained linked, but it's not something you can generally do now. So there's obviously quite a lot of manual work on the back end that sometimes needs to be done to support this. But as you say, if they've done it once, then why on earth is it not being done now? And the silence only makes it more annoying, I think, for players.
Yeah, I mean, they have communicated, and I think I said Fortnite, maybe it was Rocket League. Maybe I'm mistaken, and it was Rocket League that enabled crossplay across all platforms, or maybe both, I can't remember. But reason for Sony to do it is to encourage, since they have the biggest install base, is to tell people, well, just join where everyone is. And their messaging was incredibly frustrating when they got, you know, in the beginning, they responded with a very carefully crafted PR statement that was very clearly not answering the issue. Their argument was, well, we enable crossplay with iOS and PC, and you have a huge community of people on PlayStation 4 that you can play with, and that's all we have to say on the matter. And it was so frustrating to have them say it like this. Like, it was like, yeah, well, sorry you're mad, but F off.
The frustration is that, you know, to me, it kind of looks like it's purely to stop any potential benefit to a local competitor. You know, they're happy to do it with iOS and with PC and things, and things that aren't developed by another Japanese company, but they don't want Nintendo to get any kind of benefit here. And, right. And I find that very backward and unrealistic, and the only people losing out here are the players, and that means that the only other people that will eventually lose out will be Sony itself.
Exactly.
It's daft.
It's especially frustrating in light of the whole line of communication that Sony has been pushing since the other PR debacle of this generation, which was the Microsoft announcement of the Xbox One, where Sony very quickly and cleverly created that video of, I can't remember who it was, but the two executives saying, here is how you share your games on PlayStation, and just handing out one game from one person to the other. And they actually, sources tell us that they scrapped similar plans that they had to Microsoft to enable DRM on all games in order to profit off of this messaging blunder that Microsoft made. And when you craft your entire messaging, you know, they're for the players tagline that comes at the end of every ad that they do, and then you do something that is so obviously anti-consumer. It's a phrase I don't really like, anti-consumer. It kind of makes it sound like there's a good and evil in this world. We're really in this world of, you know, corporate decisions and communications, when really the only decision making comes with, does this decision align with our corporate interests? And hopefully, ideally, the corporate interests will align with the consumer's interests. But really, the only reason Microsoft and even Nintendo are doing this is because they are at a disadvantage in the market, and they're trying to gain ground and player goodwill with these decisions. So I don't think, you know, but anyway, aside from that, the stark contrast between the messaging Sony has been developing for this generation and this decision, for some reason, It irks me infinitely more than anything else that's happened in the past. It really, really bothers me. I'm not sure why. But what do you think, Daniel? Is this something that could actually hurt Sony in the long run? Could they be losing goodwill and then, as Nate suggested, actually start losing market share or mind share, which leads to market share in the future? How big a deal is it? Or is it just us in the know who are freaking out over something that will not have a huge impact in the actual marketplace?
I think it's certainly going to have an impact. We've already seen that impact straight up to E3. You know, Sony had the showing of you know, four of their biggest games. But the biggest story that came out of that was you know, there's no crossplay with Nintendo or Xbox. And as you said earlier, that did hit mainstream media. So it's not a sort of a small issue. And of course, the fact that you can't unlink your Epic account or use it on a different console is, to me at least, an even bigger kind of thing. And I think that's sort of why you saw that blow up as much as it did, coupled with the fact that, you know, Fortnite is, it is the biggest game in the world, essentially, today.
Obviously, yeah.
And so, you know, I think what it comes down to is, of course, you know, this is Sony's business decision, but they need to really decide now which direction they want to head in. When you look at, for example, what Microsoft is doing and how they're sort of pushing gaming for everyone across multiple platforms, devices, and business models, where Sony is kind of reining in a bit and going back to that sort of walled garden approach where it's all about the console and the box and yeah. Sort of, you know, you can liken it to sort of Apple and Google in that sense. And so, you know, I think Sony do need to make a decision. Mm. Whether it's going to be this year, we can't really say, obviously, but I think, you know, they'll need to address this before they sort of launch their next console. And, you know, they've already kind of said, well, okay, are we going to focus on stuff like PlayStation VR and PlayStation Now and PlayStation View and sort of, you know, our mobile gaming divisions? Or are we going to go back to, you know, we are a pure console company, and you need to buy our box and our sign up to our account to experience the pure kind of PlayStation experience? I think that's sort of the decision that needs to be made and that we're going to see made coming up in the future.
Mm. So you think they're waiting to see if this blows over and then they'll make a decision, maybe even for the next generation. But sorry, Nate, go ahead.
I think they will make a decision on this week. Like, I don't think
a second. Oh, you think it's going to go that fast? They're not going to wait more to see if it blows over?
Specifically for Fortnite, I don't think they're going to wait for it to blow over. We've seen this happen too many times before where Sony has kind of dragged its heels in coming out and saying something or has said something one day and then the next day, like literally the next day, has sort of backtracked and done something and said something different. And I think that this is something that for a game that is pulling in as much money as Fortnite is, I mean, it is generating a ridiculous amount of cash. You know, Sony has board members and shareholders that will be saying, why is everyone hating on us right now? And what are you doing to address this? What are you doing to fix this? Are we losing money because of it? The answer will be yes, they almost certainly are. And so there'll be pressure internally to make the right business decision. But Sony just seems to take too long for the public to actually make that decision. So I think that's why they've not addressed it head on, because they're discussing it internally.
It's very possible. It's even likely. But, you know, they're coming from a world where that kind of mindset made sense. There's a little bit of hubris, which is frustrating because it kind of reminds us of the state Sony was at the launch of the PlayStation 3, where they made a lot of bullheaded decisions, thinking, well, the market will adapt, most notably the price of the console. And it's not a one-to-one comparison, but it's the same kind of attitude. They're thinking, we are the big dog here, and people have to adapt to the way we want to do things. Which, again, I think it worked perfectly well until, you know, the conversation started happening maybe 2 years ago and really started heating up in the last few months. But it made sense, especially, as I said, when there were two entrants in the market. Now that Nintendo is also a powerful player, again, it kind of puts in focus the fact that people play games everywhere. And we have, of course, iOS and PC and other consoles, but the games as a service are playable everywhere. And it's not the same world that it was even a year ago. So the Sony stance that made sense 2 years ago, all of a sudden, it seems like they're waking up and going like, wait, what? What's happening? Why is this a big problem now?
Completely. And it's not going to go away. I mean, the fact is, people expect content, whether it's games, whether it's entertainment, media, messaging, whatever it is, people now are beginning to expect cross-platform. They're expecting things to be able to be picked up one place, put down, and then picked up another. You know, I mean, the Switch took a very hardware approach to that. You know, is it a console? Is it a portable system? But you look at what's happening elsewhere in the industry. I mean, obviously, we've got PC and Mac that can play into interchangeably, but I mean, more recently, Apple announced that it's going to let iPad apps run on the Mac, you know, and the iPad has a gigantic archive of games on there, and that's going to open up questions about whether Mac and iPad gamers should be interacting or playing together. You know, you've got what Microsoft's doing with its games for Windows and Xbox and allowing players to cross-play on those platforms. It's just, it's the way it's going. So Sony needs to not be seen as having a siloed mentality, because games are getting more social, more interactive, more kind of omnipresent across your devices. And right. So blocking off the ability for people to play with each other is just... it's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense.
It's really a mindset from even, I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago, but it's a few years ago, and things have been changing because of all of this, because of the fact that just watch something on YouTube and keep watching it on another platform. Netflix is the same, everything. It goes beyond gaming even. But let me go back to Daniel. You're saying, Nate, it is going to make business sense to allow crossplay because of the bad buzz. I'm wondering, Daniel, you work with numbers. Will it actually, I mean, I don't know. Does it make sense for Sony to relent on this, or would it hurt them more? I have a hard time seeing how they actually benefit, because the console generation is almost over and they've won it handedly. It's not like people, because they allow crossplay, are all of a sudden going to run and buy an Xbox instead of a PlayStation, especially since the draw to PlayStation is all of the exclusives that are going to stay. But does it make business sense beyond the goodwill issue for Sony to allow it, or does it not really matter in the money department?
Right now, there's two big issues, which is crossplay itself and the fact that you can't link an Epic account to a different device.
Right, so that's the most frustrating.
That second big part is actually, you know, a very, very big reason for people to, one, have to get a new account, just to use it on a different device. And two, sort of, yes, there's goodwill behind it, but a lot of people are just simply going to get a new account, start spending elsewhere, just because of that one issue. So if that's sorted, which Sony really should do, because that's, you know, it should be a simple thing, essentially, then, yeah, that's not going to have a big business impact. It's more of a, I don't know, I'd say it's petty, to be honest. Yeah. But
you know, that's why I'm wondering if, because the two things are crossplay and essentially what is cross save or cross progression. And I'm wondering if Sony is also barring cross progression, and that's why Epic is having to resort to that, you know, petty practice of actually blocking your account from being linked from other manufacturers, or if it's Epic doing it. Because they actually, maybe it's Sony. Maybe it's Sony saying we don't want cross save or cross progression either. But yeah, so
I'd imagine it comes from Sony.
Okay, so that would be your interpretation.
Mm. Even then, there should still be a way to unlink accounts, which you can do for others, I believe. I have to check it 100%, but I think that's the case.
Right. The fact that you can't unlink, and for those who don't know, it means that if you've ever linked your Fortnite account to your PlayStation account, then it means you can never play with that account on Switch or actually on Xbox. But as I was saying, it didn't really matter before, because it was just, well, you're on one or the other. Usually you don't play on both. Usually.
Yeah. I think, you know, Sony will need to change this. From a business perspective, I think it can make sense as well, just because, you know, Sony does have the biggest player base. And so, as you say, that's essentially an advantage for them, you know, right now. Whether they'll address the specific crossplay issue, you know, this soon remains to be seen. But I think the bigger issue about sort of unlinking accounts and you know, actually being able to transfer even cross progression or whatever, you know, that side of it is, just being able to do that, I think, is something Sony to address very quickly.
Yeah, I think it would be a good compromise, because the only thing that this creates now is, oh, wait, I shouldn't play on PlayStation because then I can't play anywhere else, quote unquote, yeah, you know, anywhere else.
Exactly.
So enabling it would be, okay, whatever. If I'm playing on my PlayStation, then I can't play with my friends somewhere else, but at least I can use my account and cross progress, which would have interesting ramifications for other games. Like I'm thinking of Overwatch, for example. If you can cross progress, it would, you know, make it easier for people to play on the console. That's a different issue, but there are many games like that. So, all right, let's move on to another topic that is also Fortnite related. First of all, if you're wondering why this is such a big deal, Sensor Tower, which is an analyst firm, estimates that Fortnite generated $100 million in its first 90 days on iOS alone. On iOS alone. So that is how much money it's generating. It is a huge deal. And the business model that they're using is something that we've seen elsewhere. We've seen MOBAs implement a version of this, but not necessarily exactly the same. But they are using the Battle Pass, which I've kind of, you know, had my issues with in the past. I talked about it here. I think I'm coming around. I think the idea is actually pretty clever. I've discussed it with many people and I'm seeing the light. I'm not entirely convinced that all of the implementations are completely kosher, just like for any other business model. I think there are good and bad implementations of most business models. I'm not going to get into the specifics, but the bottom line is it's making a lot of money and it seems it's becoming the flavor of the month or of the year or maybe of the decade, especially after the loot box issues that we've seen in the past year. And PlayerUnknown's Battleground is adopting it. By the way, PUBG is not doing too badly. They just announced they have sold 50 million copies and have 400 million total players, over 200 million monthly, I think. And that includes, of course, the mobile version. So that's how big the mobile version is. But it's doing really well. 50 million copies sold, even by itself, is a huge number. But they're creating their own version of the Battle Pass, which is the Event Pass. It's funny, as PUBG Corp is suing Epic for essentially copying them, they are very clearly copying it one-to-one in the business model department. And Rocket League is also implementing a Battle Pass, or what they're calling the Rocket Pass. There are little differences here and there. The PUBG version gives you access to some cosmetics that aren't accessible elsewhere, that you would need to pay for individually, but then you only have access to them during the event when you reach them and things like that. For those who don't know, the Battle Pass, the way it works is that every season, and seasons might have varying lengths depending on the game or the platform or the time, you buy into a progression which gives you gain XP after you've bought into it, or actually even before you've bought into it, but then you don't unlock the items. And every so often you gain an item, which is usually cosmetic only, and you gain an item that is included in the Battle Pass, and you have this progression that goes over the length of the season. And in some cases you can gain enough in-game currency to buy an extra a Battle Pass for the next month if you play enough. That's playing quite a bit, but it's possible. I've had someone on Twitter commenting to me that that's actually possible. So you just need to pay for the first one. And then if you're engaged enough, you keep getting the battle passes for quote unquote free. So that's an important element. But essentially what it turns into is an optional subscription, which is funny because I think if you told people you have to subscribe to our game to get this or that, people would be very angry, even if it was, you know, $2 or $3 or $5. In the case of Fortnite, it's a $10 subscription for roughly 70 days season. So it comes down to about $5 a month or $4 a month. And that would be, I think, unacceptable if it was presented in that way. But if you present it in a Battle Pass format, then everyone's cool with it. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, is the Battle Pass becoming the new standard for online like games as a service format, or is it just a specific thing for these few games? I think with the skittishness of loot boxes after the Battlefield scandal, I'm wondering if more people, because it could work in other games as well, as long as you have cosmetic stuff or stuff to give away to players, it could work in fighting games, in many different games. What do you think about Battle Passes, Nate? Is that a healthy business model? Are you iffy on it? What do you think?
It depends how you define iffy business model. I mean, I met a guy called Ilkka Paananen, who's the CEO of Supercell, a few weeks ago, and he told me that Supercell makes Clash of Clans and Battle Royale and a couple of other titles.
Clash Royale, free. Yeah.
Clash Royale, yeah. They're all free to play, and they all generate money from in-app payments and things, cosmetics and all sorts. And so last year, in 2017, they generated just under 2 billion euros in revenue from those four games, right? And you look at Pokemon Go, that's made over $1 billion since it launched a couple of years ago. So we're talking just gigantic sums of money that can be generated by keeping a fan base loyal and charging them for enhancements and cosmetics and things. You know, 90, I think it's something like 98% of all money generated through the Android App Store now actually is all from in-app payments. I think it's only a couple of percent that's generated from pay-to-download apps, and that includes
no
games.
No one outright buys stuff anymore.
No, and it's almost becoming a selling point in the games world in particular to say in your description that you are paid to download, no in-app payments, everything's unlocked with one purchase. And I think Square Enix does that quite well, actually, with some of its titles, that you kind of pay once and it's largely just there, nothing to add. But anyway, so, you know, my point is that I think no matter what however you brand it, whether it's a battle pass, whether it's season pass, we've seen that with things like Life is Strange. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. People pay for it, and it's a business model that works. And this really is just an evolution of that, I think.
Well, the big difference, I think, between this and many other examples is that, I mean, battle passes could theoretically give you in-game advantages, but it's not really suited for that. It's mostly cosmetics. It's optional. And the lack of randomness, rather, is what a lot of people are harking on to say this is a good business model. I think I mostly agree. I do think that I've said this before. I've gotten a lot of hate for it, but I think in some cases, loot boxes can make sense, especially since you can get stuff realistically when it's well implemented without paying for them. I play a lot of Overwatch, and maybe it's a best-in-class example, but I've never paid for any loot boxes, and I have a ton, most of the items actually in that game. So I think it does make sense to implement it well, but certainly the lack of randomness and the optional nature of it makes it for the whole game is there, and some cosmetic stuff you can get if you wish to, and you only pay for one battle pass if you want to, and then you don't have to pay for anything else. It makes it seem like possibly the healthiest. I mean, I wonder between this and just DLC packs or content, like you have a new adventure or a new scenario, a new whatever. But then it's usually progression content. Like if you're thinking about Destiny, then you buy something and it sort of splits the player base, which a lot of companies are getting away from. And even DLC packs are getting rebranded somehow. It seems a lot of people are offering them for free with stuff on the side now. But anyway, bottom line, the battle passes seem like a pretty healthy, or at least by the community's judgment, a good case of monetizing your game. What do you think, Daniel, with your analyst's eye about battle passes, beyond the fact that, you know, it's generating a ridiculous amount of money for Fortnite?
Sure.
Is it healthy? Is it good? Is it, like, what do you think?
I think that the first thing to note is that, you know, as the gaming market expands, we're starting to see every game essentially come to as many platforms as they can. So, you know, Fortnite is on everything. PUBG is essentially becoming on everything. And so what companies are trying to find is the best business model for each platform and the best sort of way to, you know, release and reach consumers, both with the game, but also in terms of, you know, ongoing, you know, in-game spend. And so that's why, for example, PUBG is, you know, a $30 game on PC and Xbox, but it's free to play on mobile. And, you know, it's kind of shown that the traditional model on console and PC still works very well. Well, you know, you pay your $30, you get the game, that's it. But on mobile, as Nate was saying, you know, you really need to sort of, if you're going to reach that 90% who are spending, you know, in-app, then yeah, it needs to be free to play. And so Fortnite has been able to prove that you can actually do that across both. You can do it across console and PC, which League of Legends showed a while back. And you can do it across mobile as well. And so when it comes to battle passes and sort of what they offer, we've seen that again, that progression from sort of downloadable content and add-on content back in the late 2000s and even expansion passes before then to sort of season passes and other split contents, you were saying, like Call of Duty and Destiny, up to loot boxes with Overwatch, as you were saying. And now sort of we're seeing that, you know, if you want to reach consumers across those two platforms, well, three platforms, so PC, console, mobile, you want to find a business model that works across all three. Mm. And so a battle pass is actually a good way of doing it because, as you're saying, there isn't that sort of pay-to-win advantage you get, which is something that console players have been very vocal about. They don't want pay-to-win. They don't want the randomness of loot boxes. And so a battle pass where you know what you're getting, it's essentially cosmetic items and a few boosts. And, you know, it's cheap enough where it's going to keep people engaged and it's going to give them what they want. And, you know, it's a lot better than splitting up the community or having randomness involved or, you know, whatever it is that was in the past with these kind of traditional 1-8 monetization.
I would agree completely.
What, sorry, Nate?
I said I would agree with that completely. I mean, I get very, very, very frustrated when I see level design and game design and even narrative design influenced by the business. You know, that kind of the editorial. No, it's not editorial, is it? But you know, the let's say editorial. You know, I'm talking about stories and things. You know, that should be. In a way, it really should be separated from the decisions about how the game's going to make money. You know, the,
we have the
level design
hat
is
on now. It's the editorial separate from the marketing.
I wrote a feature for Wired a few years ago called "Mario Was a Plumber, Not a Businessman," and the whole argument was, you know, Mario wouldn't work. The game wouldn't work if it was, or rather, it wouldn't have been as successful if it was a free-to-play mobile game. And I think that, you know, became very clear when the Mario
Run, yeah, came out.
Mario Run came out. Like, it doesn't work. Like, if you're in an arcade and you're putting, you know, 20 pence pieces or quarters or whatever your, you know, currency is into a machine, that's a little different because you're there. It sort of forms part of a bit of a social experience. But when you're talking about stories, and particularly when you're talking about competitive advantage, being able to, you know, to have to pay to win or to feel like the game is just working around your ability to pay them, like, that's just a very, very poor show. If you want a really interesting example of this played out, there was a game on iOS a few years ago called Bombcats, and the developer, I think, I can't remember if it was when he released the sequel or if it was a rebuild or something, but he sort of went public and said, yeah, this decision to sort of build around free to play and pay to win was a terrible decision and it ruined the game. And it's still the best example of how that can go so badly wrong and ruin a game.
Mm. Absolutely. And we've seen already that Fortnite is the biggest game in the world without having to do that kind of, you know, pay to win or sort of forced add-ons or expansions or downloadable content or whatever you want to call it. The fact that everything is optional, people are still buying into it because the gameplay itself is so sort of
compelling. Addicting. Yeah.
You know, that loop is really great. Yeah, and so, you know, people want to play and they love the game. And so that's going to naturally, you know, allow for in-game spending to increase.
Yeah,
excellent. Exactly.
I think I agree with all of this. And maybe this is the business model that is, as we mentioned, PUBG and Fortnite are essentially mobile games now, given the numbers, where the players are and where the money is, it seems. So maybe this is going to be the one good thing that came out of the mobile mindset, not necessarily initial implementation, because it was there on Fortnite before it went mobile, although maybe they were thinking about this already in the beginning when the game first was designed, so that's why they implemented it. But if I really want to nitpick, and I'm not sure it's nitpicking, but I go back to the idea that it's a subscription. You have to pay for, well, you don't have to, but if you are engaged in the thing, you're going to be paying for it recurringly, right? You're going to be paying for it for every season. And the saving grace is that you don't have to, because especially because it's cosmetic. But the if you're worried about people getting the temptation of buying loot boxes or anything else, I think the temptation of paying for these things is there as well, and if you're playing the game actively, you're always going to be tempted to go for it. Again, the other difference is that you pay $10 and you're done. Of course, you can go and buy other skins that are always on offer, and that kind of irked me a little bit. It was like super shiny, and why don't you also get this? Like the little devil on your shoulder.
No, I don't mind again, that.
That's what I was going to get to. Yeah. It's like, The lack of randomness here kind of is definitely an advantage. It's like you pay for it and you're done, and you know what you're getting, and it's a more set thing, and it's still optional. So I guess, yeah, Nate, that's what you don't, what makes it acceptable to you as well, I'm guessing.
We've seen examples. I mean, you see this in the console space and on PC, where you get a release, and then there's DLC, and then there's a Game of the Year edition that bundles everything together and kind of serves as the sort of the milestone release that includes everything. And I think that's a nice way of it's a more acceptable way of doing it. I don't think there's anything wrong in asking someone to pay more for new things within the confines of something they've already paid for, because if they're enjoying it and they want more, give it to them. So, people
as long as
paid.
The initial release is satisfying, I think is the way I defined it.
And then let the market choose in that sense. And I think, in a weird sort of way, when stuff like this happens, and this isn't just in gaming, but it is particularly important in gaming, when someone does something that's really, really crap, like this is happening with Sony, I kind of like it, because it allows an industry to hear the voice of what the people actually want, and it helps other companies, other developers, and other businesses in future kind of learn from that. And businesses need to learn from failure as much as success. And so I do think that these kind of, I don't want to say hiccup, it's a pretty big hiccup, but, these gigantic industry belches, let's say, I think ultimately do allow the industry at large to learn and improve what they offer. That said, companies like, when you see what happened with the Star Wars game with the loot boxes the other day, I think didn't they bring them back in some form?
Yeah, but with only cosmetics. So
cosmetics.
That's they reworked the entire.
So it's a wake up. It's a wake up call, that company, it suffered because of that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And just going back to what Nate said a bit and yourself a bit earlier. Is the fact that, it's really about what is acceptable to the consumer, and a way of kind of engaging them and keeping them involved. And so one thing that Fortnite does really well is the fact that it has these sort of limited time events where, you can only do this for a certain amount of time, or, hey, this is just coming to the game. There's always these updates and sort of events and things going on. And so, just like with how mobile games got their start, you're only paying, $5, $10 a month or whatever it is, it's essentially likening it to a 99 cents in-app purchase for an extra life or whatever. Obviously, this is a bit different. But the fact that it's, you're not paying $60 every time to boost up the game. You're just paying $5, $10 here and there, and it's optional. It's not forced in any way in terms of, you having to buy it. And then there's no sort of pay-to-win element behind it. And so giving people that choice, giving people something that's acceptable to them, and then giving them something in the game, which is like, hey, well, you need to buy this now, because of this limited time event or because they've added this or whatever. That's one of the ways it's become this huge, huge thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be, going forward, sort of a model that we see more and more of.
And I think, yeah, if it's, you know, let's say about $5 a month for a game that is your main game, I'm sure, you know, Fortnite is going to switch to season every 2 months and maybe less at some point. But the $5 a month for a game that is your main game, I think is very reasonable. It's a good value proposition. So to put a cap on this discussion, big single-player narrative games, I think, are a little bit of a different beast. But for games as a service that you play continuously, is the Battle Pass the ideal business model we had all as an industry been looking for? Is that the preferred, maybe not the ideal, but the preferred one? If you had to choose which one you would want for future games as a service, is this the one you would choose or another one?
It's a combination of sort of free-to-play kind of business model, but also something that's acceptable to consumers. So whether it's in-app purchases or that are just cosmetics or a battle pass, I think that's sort of where the industry is heading a bit more. The only thing with that is, of course, you need to be a big game. You need to really succeed and nail it when it comes to the gameplay loop, the content that's always coming out, and sort of, you know, retaining a player base. But I think that's sort of what's becoming more acceptable, especially more on mobile and PC. On console, there's obviously still that, you know, people would just pay to buy a game and still then buy
extra battle pass. Yeah, and the thing about battle passes, it's so clever because it kind of engages you to keep playing because you want to see that progress, you know, made, and you're thinking, oh, I have to log in today. It's like, that's, I think, where it can go wrong. It's like this, oh, log in today. And if you log in for 30 days, then you get this. And there's a little bit of that in it. But
like in Tony Hawk games where you're doing a sick trick and your score just keeps going up and you don't want to stop.
Yeah, exactly.
But you've got 2 minutes to collect everything in the level, but you know.
Yeah. But yeah.
They should bring those games back.
Well, Session is coming. It's not exactly the same.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to... since we're talking about business models, Valve has suspended loot boxes purchases in CSGO in the Netherlands. If you remember, a few months ago, we had this decision by the gambling board that was for games that allow for trading of in-game items, which then creates third-party sites where you can sell those in-game items. It always happens. Those games were likened to gambling because there was monetary value attached to the items you would get because, again, you could sell them on third-party sites. So Valve has suspended trading in CSGO, actually. Not the I'm not sure if they suspended purchasing of loot boxes entirely, but they've done this specifically for customers in the Netherlands. So I was wondering earlier in the year, would companies block certain functionalities from some local countries if the decisions were forcing them to? And apparently, at least Valve has decided that that's the way they're going to do it. So I guess we have our answer. They are going to blocking specific countries from certain actions in-game. And so there's, I just wanted to mention this very quickly. There's an inquiry into mass shootings in the US by a governmental committee. And they are being pushed, but for political reasons, to investigate, which I guess they should, investigate every related field. And they're pushing for media consumption and gaming and violent games and violent movies and all of this. They had an interview with two psychologists this week, or last week rather. Both of them weren't super in agreement on the effects of gaming. It was specifically about that session was about gaming. Both of them weren't necessarily in agreement on the effects of gaming, But both of them were very much in agreement that the committee should look into guns as it relates to gun violence. And what was really frustrating was that the committee seems to be willing to investigate everything but guns. And that is, I mean, it relates, it's political, but it relates to games because they're pushing on investigating games and their effects, which I can understand. But they're studying everything but guns themselves. So that, I think, is worth noting. And the other thing in that field is the WHO, the World Health Organization, has added a gaming addition to its list of diseases. They publish a gigantic book, a gigantic compendium called the International Classification of Diseases every few years. And for the next edition, they are adding the gaming addition as a condition. And this, of course, is very controversial. Some people are saying that it's premature, it's actually misguided. Some people are saying, well, it's an actual problem that we have to deal with somehow, and including it in the ICD is going to unlock some research fund and people will take this more seriously to look into it and see whether or not gaming causes these issues or not. I'm a little bit torn on it as a gamer. I think I might it might color my opinion, but I tend to think, well, it's really not that different from people who got lost in books or who love movies or who... I guess the one difference is that in games we have activities that never end. If you want to play, you know, of course we had World of Warcraft had the issue a few years ago. You have you always have stories about people playing MOBAs and, you know, Dota and League until they crash in a PC bang in Korea. You have games like, you know, Destiny and others that you can play endlessly. So I understand that there's a little bit of a difference, but still, I'm not sure. Another point of contention is the fact that, is it a cause or a consequence, and, you know, of depression or anxiety and things like that? I would guess, I mean, I'm not a doctor, so my opinion might not be relevant, but it seems like it seems like it could have adverse effects in general understanding, and people going overboard in thinking, oh, games cause these kinds of issues. And we've been through all this before, so it's kind of depressing to me. But on the other hand, if it does allow for more studies and actually giving a name to something that is actually happening in real life, I mean, there's no definitive conclusion on this. And some people say that it will help people, health professionals diagnose these issues. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this like, should we shut up and listen to the doctors, even though they themselves are not managing to make a decision or to be unanimous on it? Or what do you think of all of this, Nate?
Well, for a lot of this, there's the obvious sort of disclaimer that more research is needed. I think it also differs massively based on culture. I think it also massively depends on your view on sort of wealth, because in the similar reason that you see that people with lower incomes are more likely to be smokers, you see people going to different levels to get sort of their fix, if you like. And I totally believe that gaming addiction is a thing, because if you look at the way games reward you, there's a feeling of excitement when you achieve something or you win something in a loot box or you get that no scope kill or whatever. And
but is it more than food or good books or, you know, I think that's where the
Yeah, it is. It's closer to drugs. Like, in terms of the actual chemical changes in the brain, it's closer to the reason why people do drugs and continue to use drugs, because of the, you know, release of dopamine and things like that.
Sure,
like,
but you could say that about sugar.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, all of these things are under the same category. And I don't say the same for books, but I would say the same for food. Absolutely. Mm. You know,
and I guess there are conditions that are diagnosed and classified as disordered as it relates to food.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, an addiction, I'm not sure the exact dictionary definition, but it's along the lines of when, you know, when something is, you know, you compulsively do something at the expense of something else, even if you don't necessarily want to. And that's definitely, I think, what some people will have with gaming. If you go on YouTube and look for people who've just had gaming fatigue, the people posting videos about how they just had to stop playing because it felt more like work than fun.
No, that's true, but it happens to everyone, I think. And it doesn't, you know, to that extent, it happens to everyone. And I don't know that it, I guess I'm afraid that when you put a medical label on it, then things go overboard. And to be fair, the WHO is very clearly saying this is, this concerns a tiny minority of gamers who, by and large, you know, as a whole, have very healthy relationships with games. So I don't know, Daniel, what do you think about this? Is it, I hate it, because the more I think about it, I kind of come to see the side of people who think it should be studied and classified as a condition. But I don't want to. I don't know. What do you think, Daniel?
Sure. I mean, I think I can agree with what Nate said. And, well, as you know, I cover the China market predominantly. So one thing that's been clear there for a long time is that at least internet addiction has been, you know, classified there and sort of been a big topic there for a while. And then gaming addiction and sort of especially around sort of minors, you know, people under 18, and sort of curbing that as well. And so, you know, in China, where regulations are very strict and where, you know, all the regulators have a lot of control over what happens, you're starting to see, you know, at least, if not actual regulations, then self-regulation around that sort of stuff. And so, you know, in some games, for example, if you're under 18, you can't play for a certain, you can only play for a certain amount of time and then you've got to stop. Or you can't spend a certain amount of money, then you've got to stop. Some of that is self-regulated. Some of that is, you know, the government saying, hey, you know, you can't play after midnight if you're under 18 or whatever. Yeah. And so there's a lot of that coming in. Again, that's more to do with China because they've sort of identified it and they want to create a healthy environment and have a lot of control over
and you also have
what goes on there.
You also have gamer detox camps, which I don't know, maybe.
Not so much anymore. They were, I mean, yeah, they're still around, but they were more of a thing in the past. And I think, you know, that's a lesson to learn from in terms of, okay, we've identified it's an issue, especially with the WHO here. But then, you know, you need to research it more and work out, okay, well, how do you actually treat it? Do those camps work? Do they not work? Clearly, some of them don't work. Because of the stories you've probably read in the past, but you know, I think it's good to look into it, and it's good to get some more research around it, and hopefully, you know, as you say, there is that minority that's, and as Nate was saying, you know, it does feel good to game a lot, and you get that sort of dopamine release when you do whatever it is.
And the opposite can be true as well when you don't succeed. You know, that's it's another thing that can happen. And I think, you know, the solution to this is absolutely educative, and it is not legislative at all. I don't want to see any governments trying to impose any kind of ban on gaming at all, because I think it's in the hands of either parents or in ourselves or possibly even the game's developers. But, you know, unlike drugs, you know, you can take drugs that physically alter the nature of chemicals in your brain. You know, games cannot do that. You can't play one game as a brand new player and instantly be addicted. There's a longer onboarding period, if you like, for a game, and the addiction comes from the better you know and the more you engage with it, the more addictive and the more fun it becomes. Whereas if you start shooting up heroin, like, yeah, you're probably going to get addicted to that extremely quickly, and they should never ever be conflated. But the result, but a lot of the reasons for the addiction is, you know, can be similar for certain things. And I feel it. I totally, completely, 100% believe gaming addiction is a thing, because I believe I have it to a certain degree with some of these competitive card games.
But that's the thing. Everyone does with everything. And the line is difficult to you know, to trace and to know, because you could say I'm addicted to eating fat and sugar. You know, we all do to an extent. Some actually turn it in. I mean, it turns into a problem for some, for sure. But I don't know. Maybe that's it is closer to food than to drugs. I have an issue with the word addiction because I think it carries more meaning than or in the public consciousness than it should, but maybe it's actually medically accurate. And it's true. I have, you know, I've chronicled my issues, quote unquote, with Overwatch, where playing competitively and not managing to rise in ranks actually made me upset and made me physically like I had bursts of, I guess I can say, violence. Like I would, you know, it's like the issue of throwing your controller on the ground or like going like, and slamming on your desk or something.
And, yeah, and I've done that, definitely. Yeah, we've all done that.
But that's the thing. Everyone's done it, right? And that is not addiction, but maybe for some people. And they are, again, they are saying, you know, if for most players, it is a healthy pastime. I'm just worried. I hope that the general public will understand that. And maybe we're old enough now that we will understand, well, you know, some people might have other issues that are conflated with this that turn into a serious clinical problem that should be looked into. But for most people, it's fine. It's just, you know, you want to play a little bit more before when you really should be going to sleep, but it's not worse than that. And hopefully we now, because we have all played games, if we're under 30 or 40, we'll understand it. But
yeah, I mean, this is why I prefer the term compulsion rather than addiction. Yeah. Because, you know, I think addiction in most cases is probably too strong, even though I do believe that it exists. I think compulsion is a little more accurate. But the other side of it is that, you know, games by themselves have evolved so much over the last 20 years. You know, they are now so much of a social experience that some of the concerns I think people have is that for an introverted, individual or younger person, perhaps, but it's certainly true of older people as well, you know, who don't feel the need to go outside or they don't feel confident going outside, but they can feel confident interacting with other people via video games. You know, there is an argument on both sides of the fence as to whether that's healthy. On the one hand, they are socializing, they are engaging, they are talking, they're using those parts of the brain. On the other hand, they're not going outside and they're not doing it in person. And definitely for children, that kind of physical real-life interaction is a very important part of the developmental process. But for older people, it does differ.
I just get flashbacks to when I used to play consoles and people would think, oh, you're alone in front of your screen, when really I would go to school and talk about the games all day and make friends because they were, you know, and I don't think any, or maybe there are some very specific cases, but most people, like the kids playing Fortnite now, they're talking about it in school and having fun and doing the dances. It's not an isolating experience. And it reminds me of, you know, how books were treated in the beginning of last century. It was like, oh, you're living in dream worlds in your head and this is going to kill your, you know, actual will to do things. And anyway, all right. I guess I can't make a decision on this specific bit of news, but let's move on to a few little tidbits that we're going to go over really quickly. We've heard from many journalists who have had hands-on on Anthem and Beyond Good and Evil 2 at E3 that the games are much better when you see them behind closed doors than they were portrayed in the presentations on stage, which is very puzzling to me. I'm not sure I understand why they would. I guess it's bad decision-making on the parts of the developers. But those games actually looked a lot better. So I think it's worth noting because I was very iffy on both of them when we saw them at E3 at the press conferences. Apparently,
Ask a question? Why are people saying they're better in person? What is it specifically that's better behind closed doors?
Well, they actually got a chance to see what the gameplay looked like. They didn't get those little tiny cut chopped off bits of a mission. They actually saw the full mission, so you actually see how the game plays, how it progresses, things like that. There was a lot of gameplay at the Beyond Good and Evil 2 presentation when we only saw basically a gigantic CG movie during the Ubisoft presentation. So just seeing the game, that's like, I guess, what happened. They saw the actual game and not a very quick highlight reel of tiny 2 second shots and cuts.
I see. Cool.
I'm conscious that you covered E3 last week, Patrick, but I think that specific point is one of the things that you probably might discuss, and that the next generation is becoming sort of a big thing this year, what with Microsoft announcing that they're working on new consoles. Right. Sony said they're not going to bring out a PS, they're not going to talk about a PS5 this year, which implies that there is one. And then you've got these games like Anthem, okay, maybe not Anthem, but, you know, Beyond Good and Evil 2, Cyberpunk 2077, Elder Scrolls 6,
yeah, Starfield, really look, you know, whatever like it is. Next-gen stuff, not...
And they're all sort of, hey, you know, this is what we have right now, but it's very clear these games are coming out, you know, 2, 3, whatever years from now. Mm. And so when you sort of, you know, look at it, it reminds me a lot of sort of E3 2012 a bit, you know, a couple of years before PlayStation 4 comes out or whatever, and you've got stuff like Watch Dogs being shown. And so, you know, I think we're really getting to that point now where this is the year before, or a couple of years before, we're going to get next-gen games, and then hopefully we'll see sort of Beyond Good and Evil 2, Cyberpunk, Elder Scrolls, whatever, really sort of be demoed then.
Yeah, hopefully. You
know, and better.
That's certainly a thought that came out from most outlets. It was, well, those, I mean, maybe we're going to get them on this generation, like a double, a dual release that, like we've seen for the games last, but it seems like they're being built for the next generation, with the next generation in mind, at least.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if they came out in the last year of this generation and then be re-released for the next generation. That seems to me the best way to maximize your your sales, as we've seen with GTA 5, for example. But
And The Last of Us was a great example of that. You know, one of the best, probably the best looking game ever on that, on the previous generation of consoles. You know, it was like, it was this PlayStation swan song in a sense, like, but then it got remastered for PS4 and looked even better, but now there are better looking games already, so, you know, it's
and cycle, I've played it on both. I've completed it on both. Ah, good man. So talking about PlayStation, the PlayStation Now might be getting a download games feature for PlayStation 4 games, of course. The PlayStation Now is the streaming service from Sony, and they might be implementing the download the game and play it from your hard drive that the Game Pass has on the Microsoft side. It wouldn't be surprising. It might be announced in September. The issue is Game Pass now includes all of the first-party games that Microsoft is delivering, which, of course, Sony is not doing and is not going to do because they can sell it to you full price, so they're not going to implement it in the PlayStation Now. But so I think it's a less compelling offer, but still, it's going to be there probably if you prefer that. Valve is working on the Steam Link app for iOS, and hopefully they will be able to get it accepted on the App Store. We mentioned that it was rejected a few weeks ago, and it might be implemented, it might be accepted because it's removing its option to purchase games within the app, therefore bypassing the Apple 30%. Of course, we know Apple doesn't like that. I hope they do that and we see the app on the App Store, because I'd love to have it on my Apple TV. And Valve is releasing a Discord-like app, app on the desktop. It's called Steam Chat, I think? Something like that.
Should call it Too Little Too Late.
Well, yeah, I guess it's the kind of thing that if you're Steam or any other big publisher that has an app like this, you probably should offer some kind of service as a basic functionality thing, but probably people are going to stay on Discord now. It's too late. You're right. Bethesda is suing Westworld. Well, not Westworld, but you know that Westworld game that is basically Fallout Shelter? Turns out it is basically Fallout Shelter. The biggest hint was that there was a code error, basically a bug in the code of Fallout Shelter in early versions, that they managed to find in the Westworld game, and the code was discovered right around the time that one of the developers left the Bethesda team to join, I can't remember the name of the developer, I apologize, but they joined that developer, Behavior, there you go, Behavior Interactive. They joined Behavior Interactive at the time the bug was fixed, roughly. So the fact that it is in the game from Behavior is a pretty close hint, pretty good hint that the code was stolen. That is not a good thing for Behavior. But
I've caught someone out plagiarizing my work once before, when they accidentally included like an editorial clarification that I had personally written in the middle of somebody's quote. And they hadn't obviously paid attention to that. And so when they copied my quotes wholesale and included the bit that I wrote myself, it was a very easy job to flag it to their editor that perhaps they might want to not plagiarize other people's work.
What happened? Were they fired? Do you know?
They weren't fired. They apologized and they cited Wired, which is where I was at the time, throughout the piece. But it was ridiculous. It was it's a long story. I'll tell you another time, perhaps. But it was it was mad.
And finally, the Steam Summer Sales has started. Any games that you would recommend people keep an eye out for during the sales, or maybe jump on right now? I guess the sales don't change anymore nowadays. It's just a set thing for a couple of weeks. Anything you would recommend people get during the sales, Daniel?
Honestly, I have about 100 games in my backlog, so I haven't really started looking at new games to buy. I'm sure there's some good ones, but unfortunately, I'm staying away from the summer sale now.
You are one of the reasonable ones. It's too rare. You are too rare a breed. I'm not part of that. I went ahead and bought, what did I buy? Opus Magnum, which I had been looking at for a long time. It's a really, really interesting puzzle type game. What else did I get? I got Into the Breach, which a lot of people have been recommending. I don't think it's my kind of game, but I wanted to try it. And then Pyre, which also a lot of people have been recommending.
Yeah.
And
people have been recommending that to me as well, so I might check it out.
I haven't played it yet, but Opus Magnum is really interesting and very satisfying. I'm kind of OCD, and I'm liking that satisfying result of building your alchemical machine very much. Like when it starts moving around and it does the thing it's supposed to do, ooh, that feeling is really satisfying. And then you get to optimize it to cost less or occupy less space or do less work in less cycles. It's a very satisfying game. Nate, any games you would recommend for people to look out for on Steam?
It depends, really. I think everyone should go and buy the Elder Scrolls Online Somerset so they can come and play it with me, because I still adore that game. And it's a weird one to point this out, but I couldn't help but noticing that the original Tomb Raider games are on sale for like less than a pound or a euro.
Oh, you mean the old ones? The
original ones. I saw this morning they're like 60 pence for Tomb Raider 2, which is just a complete steal. It's still, my wife and I played Tomb Raider 1, the very original Tomb Raider, through to completion a few months ago. And it's a challenging game, like particularly by today's standards, it's very difficult. But if you want a blast from the past, I mean, they're less than a pound in the UK. So yeah, that's on my list.
I think I actually bought Tomb Raider 1 for like a buck a few months ago when it was on sale. Back in March, I just bought it. It was like, just, you know, one day I might want to install it and play it for some strange reason. So these kinds of things. I haven't installed it or played it. And I also have about 100 games in my backlog, but I guess I'm weak. I guess I am feeble with these kinds of things. All right, well, that's going to be it for the show. Thank you so much to both of you for joining me. Why don't you tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet or in real life? Nate, How about you?
Yeah, well, I also do a podcast every week called Text Message, which you can find at techpodcast.uk. Patrick's been on that at least once, I believe, as has our mutual friend, Mr. Tom Merritt. So that's that. And then on Twitter, I'm at Nate Langson, N-A-T-E-L-A-N-X-O-N. Come and talk to me about games. And then with my business hat on, I also write for Bloomberg.com and Bloomberg Business Week as well.
Excellent. And the link to your Twitter will be in the show notes, as will Daniel's, because his Twitter handle is unpronounceable. But, you know, it reminds people of good things from certain games. Where can people find what you do, Daniel?
Yeah, so on Twitter, it's JugaEX, which, you know, as you say, will be in the description. And I mean, that's essentially... on my Twitter, there's links to the Nico Partners blog, which is where I do a lot of, I guess, public stuff. But then, of course, the company I work for, so we have reports and custom stuff. So if I guess if people are looking for stuff in the China markets, you know, feel free to check out the Nico Partners website. But if you're just after sort of the blogs that I put out, then, yeah, nicopartners.com/blog. And then, yeah, my Twitter is sort of, it's a mix of everything, really. So yeah. China games, games industry, games news, whatever it is, it's there.
If you enjoy a good analyst's view on the games industry, definitely follow Daniel's Twitter. And if you enjoy quality joke making, you might be interested in his account as well. And I say quality with air quotes.
Yeah, you say quality with a...
Yeah. I enjoy it. Maybe it's because I'm a dad, but I do.
Fair enough. That's my target audience, so, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can go follow me there. It's Not Patrick everywhere. And FrenchSpin.com for the show notes. And if you want to go comment on what we said today, if you have remarks, if you want to say where we completely made fools of ourselves, or if you agreed, you can go to FrenchSpin.com. Thank you again very much, Nate. Thank you very much, Daniel. And we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Bye, everyone.